Today is Monday, October 18th, 2021, and a world to do today. Ani mekaveh l'Hakadosh Baruch Hu that we won't have the problems we had yesterday. Jack Yomo tells me he made you co-host, whatever that means. And I yelled and shouted yesterday, and thank God they're listening. And you can't, if you look carefully in back, you'll see they're working on wires. By next week, the whole system will bypass Wi-Fi, and we shouldn't have any major problems, Be'ezrat Hashem. Okay, I have a lot I want to talk about today. Following up yesterday's shiur, I already got response from around the world, and I thank Yomo for putting it up on YU Torah right after the shiur. With the whole question of going into the lavatory, I believe Jack Levenstein suggested perhaps why are we machmir? Why do we have to act like Rav Moshe? Because it's kli b'toch kli. I also thought of that you put it in a wallet in your pocket. So you should know with kli b'toch kli, one of the kalim has to be specifically not the usual. It's not made exactly for that. The wallet may not count, but it goes into the pants. The pants, again, you could make an argument that it isn't made for the wallet. He's just putting it into that pocket. Could be that the reason so many people are mekil and the Rav Moshe was looked upon as a machmir, a little bit out of the ordinary, is there's samach on kli b'toch kli. The truth is, in Reb Menashe Klein, you don't find him alluding to it. He could have made that point as well, kli b'toch kli, but the kesef, he's quoting from the Chabad Ya'ir. Secondly, I have to say that Jack sent me links to, I want to look at it be'iyun later today, but that there were many coins printed with God's name on it, and that would seem to strengthen the Chabad Ya'ir, that it's not the L'shem Shemayim or L'shem Frumkeit, it's simply to make money and have something interesting on the coins, as he uses the word L'hotzi. All right, that's a question that can hang fire, but Halacha L'maisa, the Rav did not take the money out of his pocket and the coins out of his coin purse, etc., etc. Regarding the vaccination, Rabbi Rubin told me, what about Dr. Zelenko? I just want to mention, I'm well aware that Dr. Vladimir Zelenko was a doctor in Kiryat Yoel. Satma. I believe he was born in the Ukraine, born in Kiev, a great Russian mind. Many of the Russian Jews had tremendous minds, and he was a top quality beloved doctor. He's the one that tipped off Trump what medicine to use, and as you recall, Trump was cured within a day or two. And he's made a big case against the vaccines, and he has medicine. I'm well aware that he's a great individual. But when push comes to shove, the statistics show you have a lot less chance of dying if you're vaccinated than not being vaccinated. And mind you, this morning, Yomo helped me transfer funds to a hachnasah that was just established for a family. I told you about it. I had a lot of heartache. A young man died. He took the booster and immediately went into a coma, and within a few days died. Immediately went into a coma. There was nothing they could do for him. He leaves a wife. He leaves four young children. And it's not just the name for me. It's my eldest grandson's best friend. They grew up together, went to kindergarten together, went to elementary school together, went to high school together. They grew up in Hanov, building next to building. Wonderful people. And yes, this is a case where it seems 99% certain it's a direct result. And we're playing a game with statistics. All right? I'm aware of it. I need Modela Kaddish Baruch Hu. My wife and I got the vaccine on Friday, and it's now 3-4 days later, and we're both alive and kicking and as good as ever, considering our age. So I'm aware of it, but what can I tell you? My feeling, gut feeling is I have to listen to my family physician. Now, with the whole question of the umbrella, I see that there's a tremendous response and it's developing into a world-class machloket in our world. It's in the religious Zionist world. And the big machshir, the great Rav who was machshir, the new patent, is, one second, of Avigdor Nebenzahl. Rav Avigdor Nebenzahl is the Rav of the Old City. He's a Gaon Adir, very prominent German Orthodox family. I yet knew his father. And Rav Avigdor Nebenzahl is a personality who's accepted both in the Tzionidati world and the Litvische Welt. Everyone holds from him. He's Shichmo Lamala Meha'am. And he came out giving Haskama. A lot of the opposition, what I mentioned yesterday, that the Rav Yaakov Ariel, Rabbi, formerly the Rabbi of Ramat Gan, is worried. Mechshasha yavol letaltel mitriyot eile b'chutz laretz lelo erev. All right, I don't know how big a fear this is. We have a big problem with the lulav and etrog until today, because we all understand that in every community where they're from Jews who worry about a lulav and etrog today, that happens to be an Erev. You can almost not find one kehillah in the world without an Erev. And I lectured on it for years, and I don't have to repeat myself. But even the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was supposedly opposed, right now in Lubavitch there's a big machleket going on because the Rabbanim are under pressure and they have to build a roof, otherwise they can't thrive. They can't even survive, let alone thrive. So that's one problem raised. Another problem raised, Uvda Dachol. Uvda Dachol is a very interesting question. When I moved into 18 Berlin in 1969, so the building was just built, it was just being finished. My daughter scared the heck out of me the other day. She said, "You're the only original settlers of the building left alive." And there is some truth to it, because there's another family, but they came in 2 years after us. We Mamish, are the only one from 69. God should give us strength. So I can go through the building family by family and tell you what happened afterwards. So we have an automatic elevator. It was in the contract. It was put in legally so no one could, because at that time, Rehavia was still not a frum neighborhood. It's not like Rehavia of today. And in every building, there were many chiloniim, and the chiloniim could object to an automatic elevator. When it's put into the contract that you're buying into the building, knowing there will be an automatic elevator, no one can stop the automatic elevator later. And there have been plenty of stories in Israel with these cooperative buildings and machlekes over the automatic elevator. We had problems, but that's ancient history. Today it's a different story because the building, every last apartment is owned by a Shemesh Shabbos family. So I went through all the literature on automatic elevator. And the Minchat Yitzchak, the Av Beitin of the Eidah Haredit, talking here already, an Adam Gadol, and from that world, it's not exactly the Yeshiva University world. So ultimately, you look at his Tshuvat, he can't really find the problem with the automatic elevator, but he says, Uvda Dachol. So I've often commented, that proves to me that the Minchat Yitzchak never went into an automatic elevator. Because if you go into an automatic elevator, you learn right away it's exactly the opposite of Uvda Dachol. What's Uvda Dachol? You go into an elevator, you press a button, you shoot up. An automatic elevator, you have to know the schedule, you have to know when it's running, you have to know where you catch it. my wife and I always compare, where did we catch the automatic elevator? Was it on the fourth floor coming down? We had to wait until the cycle went through 5 minutes till we got up. Or no, you walk in, and whenever the elevator is waiting for me, I say, see, the elevator knows I'm a tzaddik. It's waiting for me. So it's not uvda d'chol. That's no reason. Now, the umbrella, what do you mean uvda d'chol? Person wants to protect himself from the rain. So I saw in the opposition that they're already, if you're sick, maybe it's mutter. In other words, there's really, he worked out a system here. It's like the Tzomet microphone. I went into all the, as much as my mind can understand, the technical matters with the Tzomet microphone. And there's no doubt in my mind that Ma'ika Hadin it's mutter. But all right, it's a political question. In the United States, the Spanish, Portuguese synagogue has it. They're not concerned at what they're going to say in Borough Park. The Hamptons shul has it. Believe me, they're not concerned with what they're going to say in Flatbush about the... it becomes a political question. Here, if you say only sick people can use the umbrella, so look what you're saying. You're going to have to put a sign on the umbrella like they put on the Shabbos cars for the crippled people that it's working on a Shabbos mode. So you're going to have to put a sign on it. I am sick, that's why I'm using the umbrella. But anyway, it's a very interesting new development. And time will tell what will happen. I have to tell you, I also saw people writing about it, quoting me. I can't believe what I said yesterday. I'm not the first one to say it. That it's all the question of bacon and pork. It can be perfectly kosher, but we're not used to it. We can't accept it, you know, like it's uvda d'chol, it's something new. And someone wrote a whole article that bacon is okay, pork is not okay. If it's kosher, it's kosher. And I have to tell you, it reminded me of an absolute, absolute true story that happened to me in Malta. We never dreamt we would see the United States again. We were poor kids, we came in Aliyah, alright, so life, the Ribbono Shel Olam has his own plans. In 77 the government sent me back to speak at the RCA convention, 78, 80, the Jewish agency was involved, I taught that whole idea of Chabad Aliyah Toranit, many Shidduchim came out of it, and then I got involved with Russia, and I subsequently have traveled, I would say, a million miles by airplanes, and... But we didn't really know what was going on in America. So one time we were in Flatbush, if I'm not mistaken, it was in Flatbush on Avenue J, and it's a kosher, milchika place, and we look at the menu, and we see bacon and eggs, and we were shaking. And we look around and we see guys sitting there with long beards and big kippot and black hats. And like I'm a shagetz with the kippah shrugah. And it took us a while, you know, we had to comprehend that this is all artificial. So what we're used to, we're used to. Suddenly they come out, you corrected me yesterday, not bacon, but pork. Well, I can understand, you hear the word pork, you get frightened. On the other hand, imagine we're zeichet today that a Torah Jew has so little to sacrifice, so much to gain. It's like when we were growing up, we couldn't eat this, we couldn't eat that. What a world today. Look at it from that point of view. Baruch Hashem, Kedusha V'Tara. And I have to tell you, when it comes to a sexual life, a Torah Jew has infinitely more meaningful sexual life than any Trump and any Clinton in the world. And I know what I'm saying. Look at today's Jerusalem Post. I just told Malka over the phone. My daughter suddenly woke up and said to me, no wonder God wants to destroy the world. And she's talking about, you know, men, women, men, women, bisexual, tribe, whatever. I said, your father said that a summer and a half ago in a talk he gave for Shvut Ami that went onto the internet. Of course, it's unbelievable. Today's post, everyone should walk around naked. Look at the article on what they're going to do in Yom HaMelech. It's unbelievable. We're animals. We're in the zoo. I never yet saw a monkey get dressed in the morning. We've banished on Malbish Arumim. They've lost all human dignity. Just animals. The slut parade in Tel Aviv. I mean, just think what we're talking about. All right.
And anybody with the umbrellas make any connection to those chain of coats that...
All right, that's the sugya. No, so the umbrella, that's the whole heter is based upon the fact that it's not a real oil, it's an oil arayi. But you're opening it, it's bigger. That's the whole thing with the tefach, the Gemara in Shabbos.
That Shana cult was a new thing to help.
Yeah, and then that cult was accepted because raincoats people have been wearing. The biggest machloket with protection from the rain was Reb Moshe and Reb Menashe Klein over putting the nylon covering on the hat. But outside of that, everything was accepted. The umbrella, I had the feeling from the Rav that it was like a political statement. Dominic had a mission, I know how to learn, I'm not afraid of a new concept. We use an umbrella. They would open it before Shabbos, don't misunderstand me. But here, his chuppahs, if you look at the picture of what he developed, it's more that it's kamat tfachim, that it never really tightly closes. So it's no different than a carriage. You look into the halacha, look into Shmuel Shav Hilchata, you're wheeling a baby, and the sun is beating down on the baby, and you want to pull the cover out more. As long as it was open before Shabbos and Tefach, etc., you can pull it out. So why not this magic umbrella? All right, it'll be interesting to see the way it plays out. But if it's really raining hard and I have the umbrella and it comes out with good Hashocha, Rav Nebensal, I'll put a sign on it. I'm in my mid-80s. And anyone at that age, his health is not perfect. I'll put a sign. All right.
Different colors with different
okay. It could be. It's also a solution. All right. I want to also correct myself about Rabbi Yisachar Meir. I said last week when I spoke about him that I thought he was raised in England. I was wrong. He's born in Hamburg, and he came to Israel. When I met him in 1969, he spoke perfect English to me, English. And the answer is very simple. He grew up here during the British Protectorate. And at that time, the language that everyone learned was English. So there are many people who learned English at that time, and it became like a native language. All right. I apologize if you hear noise in the background. It's not easy to teach, but we don't have a choice. They're building and the noise is incessant. I want to come back to Meir Kahana, and I want to touch upon two concepts. One is extremely important. It's in the news now. It's crucially important. And I got a number of emails about what happened afterwards with Baruch Goldstein. Baruch Goldstein is after Meir Kahana. I believe it's 92, we can check. Meir died in 90, he was assassinated, he was killed. And then you have Baruch Goldstein, 1994. Now, here you have someone who Arabs went into a mosque, shot, killed, what was the number, murdered, something in the 20s as I recall. Let's see here, just beyond words, from 29 and wounding 125 Muslim worshippers in Ma'arat HaMakpelah. And then he was killed. And the question, of course, everyone raised is this a result of Meir Kahana? Did Meir believe in this? And I received quite a few communications. These are all students of mine, people I know intimately. And one Talmud writes to me, what about Meir Kahana? What was his interaction with Benji Baruch Goldstein? I knew him for over many years in high school camp, YU, and medical school. He was always a gentle, wonderful person. I considered him a true hero. What happened? And was this the influence of Meir Kahana? And I have a Talmud who was 1 year, I think a year behind him in Yeshiva College, and they were quite close. And he told me, Benji Goldstein, such a nice, fine kid. What happened? Another Talmud writes, yes, here's the problem. Benji was quite sweet, but he often would spend many hours in my dorm room speaking late into the night of his deep, dark, personal hatred for all Arabs. And he says Benji finally lost it and had a dark and murderous psychotic break. And here's another person writes, they knew Benji Goldstein very well in those days in YU. He was known as Benji, sweet kid, interested in scuba diving and getting into medical school. Still don't understand what happened on that Friday, that Purim day in Hebron. And here I have to say, I didn't know Benji, I only meet through his family. His sister Batsheva was my student in Mechola, and we were very close. She's a bright girl and lively, and I actually saved her, redeemed her, because something was happening. They were leaving Sinai. I mean, you have to check out the year. We were giving back land, and there were big demonstrations, and she went down. I believe it was Sinai, and she went down and was there over Shabbat and demonstrating, and Rabbi Koopman was very upset with her, and he wanted to throw her out, and I pleaded with Rabbi Koopman that you can't do this to the girl. It has to be Sinai, because I was still teaching at Michalar. It has to be in the early 80s, I would say. And Rabbi Koopman paroled her. I was in charge of her. In other words, she had to report to me once a week and tell me what. All right, fine, good. So through Batsheva, I got to meet her parents. And when her brother got married, he married a girl named Kohn, a Russian girl who was a big Kahananik. And I don't know if I taught her in Michalá, but I knew her. I believe I did teach her. But if not, I knew her from my Russian activities. And, you know, everything seemed great and beautiful. I was at the wedding. The wedding was at the foot of the Mukarabi gate, where you go up the Har Habayit. So Reb Meir was Masada Kedushin, and I either read the Ketuvah, I had the first two brachot. I mean, I knew the family. But you see, here's where you come to a delicate line. When a Rebbe teaches something, a student may take it much further. You have your limits, but a kid is a hothead. He's young yet. And in teaching and speaking, you have to be very careful. I remember with the Rabbi Goren Lange case controversy. So I did my homework, and I came out in favor of Rabbi Goren's decision. So I remember there was a student in the BMT. I remember his name. I could see his face before me. We're going back 50 years now. And, oh, did he start cursing those who oppose Rabbi Goren. So I told him, look, I support Rabbi Goren's decision, but it doesn't give me the right to maledict and curse everyone else. But a student takes it further. With Benji Goldstein, here you see Reb Meir's viewpoint, and this is why so many people are critical of Reb Meir, that Benji takes it already, go out and shoot Arabs indiscriminately. I personally believe with all my heart and soul, Meir would have never condoned such action. Meir was not alive. I said at the time, had he only asked me, look what you did to your wife, look what you did to, I think there were four children at the time, and you go and shoot innocent people? How do you know that some of the Arabs that you killed are not the descendants of Arabs who saved Jews in 29? You know that in 29, 57, 58 Jews were killed Many were saved by Arabs. Read the memoir literature. Arabs put them into the basement, put them into the cellar. Arabs blocked their doors from the murderers. That they were murderers, absolutely. But you can't go and shoot and kill wholesale. And it's very sad when you look back at the Goldstein episode. It's very sad because it's like the assassination of Rabin. It gives the anti-Torah people, the anti-right-wing people, it gives them a rallying point. This is what comes out of your viewpoints. So this is, as far as Benji Goldstein, what I believe happened was he was really convinced that the Arabs were planning a massacre. And what he should have done is immediately go to the Shin Bet, go to the army, go to intelligence. Tell them what you think. We have a government here. We have responsibility. We have people who have their hand on the pulse. We buy shalala. We pay heavy taxes. Most of it goes on defense. But don't take the law into your own hands. And this, all of us listening who are going to be mechanchim, are going to be teachers, bear in mind, if you say something extreme, a student may take it to the second power. He evidently was convinced there's going to be an attack, and by going and killing, he's saving Jews. But he acted absolutely in the wrong fashion. And for those of you who went to BMT, I just want to tell you in the autobiography, I would call it, the memoir that came out by Rabbi Hurwitz's granddaughter, the daughter of the couple that was murdered by terrorists in the Kiryat Arba, Eli, Rabbi Hurwitz's eldest son, tall, remember him, and Dina, my dear student from Washington, D.C. So in her memoir, she writes about Baruch Goldstein and how her father, who was teaching in the yeshiva in Kiryat Arba, was hysterical, and the words he was saying were exactly my words. Why didn't he go to the police? Why didn't he go to the Shin Bet? Why didn't he go to the army? You can't take the law into your own hands. And this is an absolute truism. Chas v'chalila, we try to do outside the law, try to do what we think is right. We wind up destroying all of Yiddishkeit. And the greatest proof is the news that you heard this morning on the radio. Who would ever dream that from Jews would kill other Jews in the name of Torah? Now just think what we're talking about. They just solved the murders of 30 years ago. I remember it like yesterday. And three people arrested from Shuva Banim, from Rabbi Berlin's crowd. And the lady evidently didn't actually kill. She seems to have been an accessory to the crime. She abetted them. I heard her lawyer speak this morning on the 6 o'clock, after the 6 o'clock news when I was driving here. And could you imagine the Tzniut squad? They don't like you. Your wife doesn't dress properly. You were seen with a girl. Rebbeinu shel Olam, take the law into your own hands. Jews should kill another Jew. It's beyond comprehension. And my own humble opinion is that this Rabbi Berlin is a curse upon the Torah people. What this man has been involved with. I mean, I don't even want to repeat what his own Hasidim saw when they climbed up the window. Ribbono shel Olam. All right, there's a YU connection. Do you know the connection? The YU connection is very simple, Rabbi. I had a dear chaver in YU, Menachem Goldblum, Rabbi Menachem Goldblum, the son of Rabbi Israel Goldblum. Read about Rabbi Israel Goldblum in Washington. And Menachem was a year or two younger than me. He followed me. He took over my class when I went in Aliyah. He was assistant to the Rav for a year or two. Then he came in Aliyah. And there were tzaras in the family. His wife broadened and threw away part of Torah Tashem. And they had to get divorced, four children. And he got involved in Breslov. And his son married Rabbi Berlin's daughter. So that sometimes you read about a Goldblum involved with Berlin, it's a YU connection. But this tells us we must follow Dina D'Malchuta, and we must be careful in our pronouncements. And on the other hand, Kol HaKavod to Mishteret Yisrael, that 30 years later, they can uncover. By the way, one of the bodies was never found. And now let's see if they can get out of these murderers where they buried that particular individual. Now, one more comment. That's as far as Benji Goldstein. One more comment. The book came out by Shaul Magid. And I thank a number of people sent me reviews and interviews. And Ozzy Orbach, it's an interview with someone who was a research assistant and an interview with the author. And it seems, at least from what I'm reading here, that this is a more balanced outlook on Reb Meir. An excerpt from a new book explains the very American racist system of the notorious late Rabbi Meir Kahana. This is Tablet Magazine, and a headline that frightens you. But when I read the interview with the research assistant and part of the book, word by word is what I said in my lectures right here in class. Baruch Hashem, I'm not saying something that other intelligent people are not arriving at the same conclusions. Reb Meir raised problems that everyone was afraid to articulate. These problems haunt us until today. The whole problem of Israel, is it a democratic state or is it a Jewish state? How do we balance the two? The attitude towards the Sfardim, Eidot HaMizrach. It goes step by step, the questions Meir raised. JDL, the right to defend ourselves. The interview with the lady is a lot more positive. I understand in the book, again, I don't have the book in front of me, I'm just reading what I read, that the author tries to understand where Meir had more influence, in Israel or America. And, you know, it's an interesting question. My own feeling is that the real influence of Meir was in raising these questions. Intelligent people have to deal with it. We can reach our own conclusions, but you got to give Meir credit. He never swept it under the carpet. All right, I can see Meir Kahana will live on. He'll have his admirers. He'll have his detractors. And Aaron Rekefet can only say honestly, Meir had a big role in turning him and his brother and others into Zionists in Bnei Akiva. I don't know anyone from our crowd who became a total Kahananik, but respect and understanding for Meir we have, and an understanding of the problems he raised. These are problems that we live with on a daily basis. Yeah. And above all, Shlomo, what you missed was my exhaustion to teachers. Don't be extreme in your statements, because if you're saying something that's a little extreme, a Talmud will take it to the second power. Meir Benji Goldstein. You follow? And I'm positive Meir would not have approved of what he did. Baruch Goldstein. Benji Goldstein. And in today's news, you see another example. Berlin was maledicting people who are not Sanua. Can you imagine what a maneuver he later turns out to be? And they killed two people. Two Jews killed. And by the way, their lawyers already spoke out. It's more than 30 years. What's the word they use? You can't prosecute them. Too much time has passed. Statute of limitations, correct. And you know what the police answered? They've been working on the case for 30 years so that the statute of limitations does not apply. Let's see how the courts handle this. Okay, yes, Mark.
The impact that Rabbi Kahana has until this day, when he was incarcerated in the United States, he told them, you got to give me kosher food. If you can't feed me, you got to let me go.
So it
became a big case, and I dealt with that on a regular basis, interviewing Jews, Muslims, for the certified religious diet in the federal prison.
Right. So you heard what the Rabbi Dr. Mark Weiner, who was a lieutenant colonel and was a chaplain, he just mentioned that Reb Meir deserves credit. He demanded kosher food. And nowadays, practically in every prison in the United States, you can get kosher food. Someone wrote to me, I don't want to start looking for the papers now, but Meir told him he was beaten up infinitely more in Israel by the police than he was in America whenever he was arrested. So he complained to the police in Israel, and they told him, here we don't have to worry about anti-Semitism. We don't have to, follow, we can do what we want. No one's going to call us to order. In America, how do you beat up a Jew? You know, here, police beat the heck out of you. We're also Jewish, but you're a criminal. All right, Yitzchak, I spoke about the vaccine at the start of this year. You'll pick it up. All right, let me move on. And with great joy and responsibility, I want to devote a few lectures to the Rebbetzin. Here we have a lady, we have a personality. It's not like Shlomo Carbach, where it's not all white. There's black that you have to deal with too. It's not like Meir Kahana, where it's certainly, with Meir, is it more black than white, more white than black? It all depends upon your focus and outlook. The Rebbetzin was one of a kind, and I have to say that it was a slip in my life, B'nai Akiva. I look back now, I knew the Rebbetzin, she had two brothers, I knew both brothers, the older brother Yaakov, the younger brother Binyamin, or Brudy as we knew him, B-R-U-D-Y as I recall. I don't know if I ever met her parents, but I knew her cousin whom she marries as well. He was a little older, Meshulam, he was also in B'nai Akiva, and from the Esther, when you think back, was a little woman. I mean, it's amazing. Look at small people. Rabbi Joe Lookstein, how tall was he? Rabbi Steve Riskin, how tall is he? Rabbi Aaron Cutler, how tall was he? I don't think any of these people were much over 5 foot. And Esther Jungreis, I think she was 4'9", 4'10". And these little people, they changed the world, plain and simple. And Esther Jungreis, first we'll talk about her life on a very superficial fashion, and then we'll go back and try to understand and see. All right, to put her into context, her years, 1936, 2016. She was 80 years old when she died, 79, 80 years, or 80 years old. She was a year older than me. So I can't, you know, I knew her very well. It was more or less my shade, but although a woman by nature, if I'm 20 and she's 21, I'm a kid yet and she's an adult. She was born in Hungary. She was born in a city called, if I'm pronouncing it right, Szeged, Hungary. S-Z-E-G-E-D. Now, her father was Reb Avraham, her mother was Miriam Jungreis. The Jungreis family was spread all over Hungary. It's hard to say. I would say there were 50 well-known Rabbanim in the Jungreis family before Hitler. It gives you an idea. They were all over the place. What's interesting is the city she was born in. The Lubavitcher Rebbe. You look at the Rebbe's life, if you remember my lectures. This man, his understanding of the average Jew who's so far from Torah, was overwhelming. His love, his understanding, where did it come from? It's very simple. the Rebbe was one of three boys. The other two brothers were not religious. The one who survived the Holocaust, who was the Rebbe's best friend in his youth and was a genius, he went into the big world, became a mathematician, wound up in Palestine, from there to England. He's not religious. By the way, it was his sole daughter who was the only blood relative of the Rebbe at the funeral. Think what I'm telling you. The daughter came in from England, and it was the Rebbe's niece. And I don't know if she's religious, but she had the feeling at least to attend her great uncle's funeral. But the Rebbe, he didn't grow up. He grew up in communist Russia. Just think where he grew up, and he knew what was going on beyond the ghetto. It's not like growing up for the sake of argument in Munkach or growing up in Satmar. He grew up already. It's a miracle that he became who he became. But that's life. This city where Esther Jungreis was born, where her father was Rav, that was a city where the Nialar community was in the majority. Now, when I say the word Nialog, it's a word only used for Hungarian, what we would call in our language, conservative Judaism. Anyone on the Nialog, I'll give you an example, big synagogues, music on Shabbos, big organs, polished organs. It's interesting, it's one of their first innovations. It could even be, it has to be researched, but I have a feeling that men and women sat separately in some temples, but an organ they had. Rabbi Wiener agrees with me. I remember that from my studies on Torah history. Like Germany, of course, they were greatly influenced. That was the part of Hungary next to Germany, nearest Germany. So you see, Esther Jungreis grew up already. She was exposed to Jews changing the service, being Mechalel Shabbos, not Makpid on Kashrut, or at least not Makpid on Kashrut out of the house. It was not a ghetto experience. She was exposed to the big world. She knew what was going on. Now, she's a little girl, as you can see. She has an older brother, a younger brother. And the Nazis first start working over the Jews in Hungary in 1944. They get there late. And the families are being deported. And her family is being deported with everyone else. Going through the hell, imagine you lose your identity, lose your home, lose your profession, lose your money. It's beyond comprehension. And while they're being deported to what ultimately would have been a death camp, they are transferred to the train that is the Kastner train. Kastner train stops in Bergen-Belsen. They're there a little while. From there, everyone goes back on the train and they wind up in Switzerland. Their lives are saved. Now, what I'm touching upon here is a topic that we will never get an ultimate answer. Rudolf Kastner. His granddaughter is in the Knesset. She's enough to make you sick every morning if you believe in Torah to hear her pronouncements and lifestyle. Meirav Michaeli. But she had a grandfather, Kastner. And some people in the world will bless Kastner, call him the greatest tzaddik that ever lived. For what reason, Shlomo? He saved the Satmar Ruv. And you know how many Satmar Chassidim there are in the world today? How many identify with him? We're talking hundreds of thousands of Jews, some total chassidim, some partial. And he was saved by Rudolf Kastner. Rudolf Kastner later prays for what he did. He's assassinated in Israel. He had to make decisions. He negotiated with the Nazis. And once you get involved, who do you save, who don't you save? No matter what you do, you can't be right, you can't be wrong. Anyone who criticizes Kastner because he saved relatives is an absolute fool. Adam Korev Eitzel Atzmo. There's no one in this world, if you're a decent human being, who won't save his own mother and father. So that's not a criticism of Kastner. But he negotiated with the Nazis. He agreed to this, agreed to that. So much has been written. You all know the child. I can't go into detail. Malkiel, you can look it all up. Malkiel Grunwald, a Mizrahiite from Hungary, who sued him in court. And he was charged with libel. And the judge found Malkiel Grunwald guilty and fined him one agora, one penny, that everything he said was basically correct. You know, it could be it's libel, could be it can't be absolutely proven, but he was absolutely correct. But honest we have to be. He saved the Jungreis family. Now, I'm going to cite a book that just came out on the Rebbetzin. The book is written by a Rabbi Nachman Seltzer. If anyone is listening who knows Rabbi Nachman Seltzer, he's an American of American origins, living in Beit Shemesh, I'm told. I would greatly appreciate it if you could ask him why he left out the whole story of how the Jungreises were saved. When you read the book, it's very disjointing. Here they are suffering under the Nazis, and a minute later they're in Switzerland. And there's no explanation. And to me, it seems indecorous and not proper Torah behavior. Hakarat HaTov. You remember I quoted to you the Chovat HaLevavot, that the basis of Torah, basis of religion is... I'm quoting him. I gave you the exact source. Hakarat HaTov. And here, this man saved the lives. There's only an Esther Jungreis in the world because of Kastner. Why did he leave it out? I mean, it's an art scroll book. I don't expect it to be a PhD from Hebrew U or Revel. But that's not the point. This is elementary, and it's disjointing to read. Here they're suffering, and a minute later, they're free. What happened? Kastner, Hakarat HaTov? Okay. Now, how did he save them? Well, the little bit we understand from the Jungreis family is it really was Hashgacha Pratit Min HaShemayim. As I mentioned, the Jungreis family was a very large rabbinic family all over Hungary. In one of the offices that dealt with the Jews and the Jewish agency, a relative worked for Rudolf Kastner's office. And this relative arranged that when the train would pass where the Jungreises lived, they should be able to get on. And that saved their life. The cattle car was opened, and the entire Jungreis family was transferred onto the so-called Kastner train. And that saved their lives. From there, a lot has been written, a lot of memoir literature. The train wound up Bergen-Belsen. People were worried, but afterwards, Eichmann kept his word, Himmler kept his word, and the train wound up in Switzerland. They were paid. They were given a hefty price. Kastner arranged it, the Jewish agency, money was put up, and we got to give Hakarat HaTov. Was Kastner right, wrong? My own life experience has taught me you can't even ask the question. you have to save who you can. And Kastner was asked, and this came up in his trial, and in all the memoir literature this is quoted, who did you save? How did you pick these people? Imagine, they're going to ask me, save 1,000 people, pick them out. All right, I'll pick out 1,000 people who are from, who are Shomer Shabbos. You're going to ask Kastner's granddaughter to save 1,000 Jews. She'll pick out 1,000 people who eat pork, real pork, on Yom Kippur. What did he do? And he explained. Does anyone know? He coined the phrase, I don't know if he coined the phrase or his lawyers, they coined the phrase, Shlomo, Noah's Ark. What's unique about Noah's Ark? Two of each species. He said, I thought the world would come to an end, all these Jews would be killed. I want to recreate the Jewish world after the Holocaust as it was. Two cows, two monkeys, two chimpanzees, two of each species. And I took irreligious Jews, religious Jews, Zionist Jews, Mizrahi Jews, Aguda Jews, Satmaruv Jews, and that's who he saved. Fascinating. And he did, when all is said and done, when you look back, there are hundreds of thousands of frum Jews in the world today that go back to the Kastner train. Okay. Now here you come to another problem that also comes up time and again in the memoir literature. If not for Britain, if not for the English, Israel would be a totally different state today. When the war ended and the Hungarian Jews and the Polish Jews, the Russian Jews, you don't even have to elaborate because they certainly didn't want to go back. But it's communism. But the Russian, the Polish and Hungarian and other Czechoslovakian, Romanian, many of them dreamt they could go back. Their homes were there. Their furniture was there. They couldn't. But then they found you went back. There was a pogrom in Kilts, remember? And I write about it in the Silver Era. They killed over 250 Jews, more or less, Lower Lane, in one day. And go back? Who? So everyone would have come to Israel. 99%. But then you had the problem with the white paper to get in, and there was just a limited number. So endless people who really wanted to come to Israel in 45 and 46, by 47 already they realized they're never going to get in, and by that time relatives arranged for them to come to America. Everyone, you dug up a relative or you were sponsored, I need not tell you, America. So the Ingres family is one of these many families who really wanted to go to Palestine, but by 47 realized we're not going to get there, we're not going to get there for years, and they wound up in America. They wound up in Brooklyn, they reconnected with the Ingreses that were saved, among them I think it was a second or third cousin, Meshulam Halevi Ingres, and Esther later marries him, and Baruch Hashem, it was a beautiful marriage, four children, and they wind up in, and I remember him so well from Bnei Akiva. Esther was very short, he was already tall. It's amazing, like we used to call, there's an expression, a lulav and an etrog. That was a couple like a lulav and an etrog. And they wound up in North Whitmere. Now here, I'm going to throw out a question that if anyone in the world can answer me, I'll be happy. Meaning, they wound up in the synagogue, and people take for granted Esther and Meshulam organized the shul. It was called North Whitmere Jewish Center, Orthodox Congregation, Ur Torah. And I have the feeling, I saw a whole video online, it's amazing what's available on YouTube, Sir, a whole interview with the original members of the shul, and most of them were not strictly Orthodox. No one there with a beard, no one there with a uniform. What, excuse me?
It was the first Orthodox synagogue.
Yeah, I understand. But it was like Maplewood, New Jersey. It reminded me of my Balabatam 100%.
I remember dining there in the basement of their house.
Right, and I got the feeling it was a communal shul. It's not that the Jungreisers owned the shul. That's what I'd like to know, because there was a battle over the mechitza.
I had a cousin my age then. He was in high school. They sent him to High Life. And on his own, he left Temple Hillel.
And he joined...
And then his parents...
Right, beautiful. But that it was an Orthodox shul, I'm not questioning. I'm only curious to know, I got the feeling it was not a shtibel owned by the Rebbe. It was an Orthodox shul, and he was hired as the first rabbi. And they built the community. Because I'll come to it, you'll see I have material from the biography of Esther, that they had problems over the mechitza, but they made clear there has to be a mechitza, and that's nothing that the congregants can decide. But I'm just curious, who is the rabbi in the shul today? Is it a Jungreis or is it someone?
No, I don't think so. No. In fact, there was a whole problem with that. She wanted to keep him in the family.
Uh-huh. So that's when I have a feeling it's a public, it was a congregation that was organized. It reminded me of how Maplewood began when I came in 62. When I heard these Balabatam speaking and their attitude, I would have substituted the name Rothkopf for Jungreis. I mean, it was the same story. And again, the mechitza, that was the problem in all the Orthodox shuls in the 60s into the 70s. Already it starts to subside, but it was a problem. Okay. So they go North Woodmere, and I actually checked out where it's located, and I don't have to tell you, that area today is filled with Torah. It's a different story. It's the five towns, and it's Woodmere, and wow, within walking distance, Eish Kodesh, and the young Israel of Woodmere. This is North Woodmere. Excuse me, Vic? But I would estimate from the Israel of Woodmere to the Jungreis shul, you could walk it in a half hour or less. Am I about that? That's what I saw on the map. And that's where they began in the rabbinate. Now, Reb Meshulam, again, when you have a very dynamic wife, this too is a challenge to know your role. My daughter always would say, my eldest daughter, you know, her husband was a high-ranking officer in the army, my son-in-law, but my daughter would always say, in this house, I'm the general. And, you know, she's Nishi Yot, my daughter today is so famous, people calling me, Yashikai, whatever, Baruch Hashem. My wife raised good girls, all of them, Kanai and Hara. So, he was a fabulous husband. He had a wife who her soul was exploding. She had visions way beyond North Woodmere. And he was a nachiyasa, a total support. And I call your attention to it because I've seen life, and I've seen men and women and husband and wife and interaction. And I know in my own family, my grandchildren, my wife always says to our granddaughter, so how do you feel? You have a doctorate and your husband doesn't. You know, we come from a world, the man has to have the doctorate, not the wife. She can have it too, but first the man. No, today it's it's fine. He does his thing, I do my thing. No problem. No problem whatsoever. All right, this is the world. Today we have to live with reality. And her vision was exploding, and the assimilation, the intermarriage, and slowly but surely, she's a Rebbetzin. She's speaking. The kids are older. She's not only speaking in the shul, she's invited elsewhere. And then, of course, they come up with the idea. We'll see how it germinates. Shlomo Kalbach has a hand in it, that they're going to take Madison Square Garden, the Felt Forum. I'll explain exactly later. And she's going to talk to the world. Anyone would have laughed. You're taking the second biggest hall in Madison Square Garden, and who's going to fill it? Who's going to be there? Laugh. No. She said, Mark Wiener will be there. Shragai Kaslar will be there. He was there too. And thousands of others. They filled the hall beyond capacity. No charge. Wouldn't charge. Open to the public. Got a supporter. We'll see to rent the place. Cover all costs. Someone from Lawrence did it. His wife said, I like the idea. She gave her husband his orders. And of course, following that, they couldn't let go of the Rebbetzin. Hineni was born. Now, Hineni is the pasuk we just read. Kachnat Bincha, we're going to read this week. Kachnat Bincha Yechidcha Shehafta Tishkva Leli Ola. Hello. It's an unbelievable pasuk. And what does Avraham Avinu say? Hineni. Hineni. And that's the way it should be pronounced. A lot of people pronounce it Hineni. Where did they get Hineni? From the Chazanon, Hineni, etc. There's nothing Hineni. Yeah, it's good Hebrew, right or wrong. Hineni, it's easier to say than Hineni. But Hineni is born. You know where they meet? They meet in Kehillat Yeshurun, KJ. Shlomala, have you ever been to KJ? KJ is the finest Orthodox shul in the United States. That's dignity. No schleppers are there. When they say Baruchu and a few hundred people are bowing with the Baruchu, if you put their bank accounts together, you're over $100 billion at least. You know, these are real. And by the way, Shmirat Shabbat today, this is, you know, not America of 100 years ago. And they have a beginner's service run by George Rohr. The Prime Minister's wife became through that beginner's service in KJ. Okay? Dignity, you're talking George Rohr, a Yid tzaddik. You understand? She and KJ. Now, very interesting is, and people criticize the foolish people, that she reached out to the wealthy crowd. You know, when you talk like that, it's foolish. KJ offered its facilities. KJ was very well located. And what's wrong with reaching out to the wealthy crowd? I can tell you when the Rebbe died, 770, I was at the funeral. I was in America at that time. It happened to be in America. And I was at the funeral. And there's one little house, like around the corner. And when the Rebbe's casket was wheeled out of that little house, about 40, 50 people walked down, including some people I knew, including a close friend. I asked him later, so he admitted to me, in that house were all the people, the biggest supporters of the Rebbe. My friend gave the Rebbe $1 million a year. $1 million a year. All right, plain and simple. So, nothing but he's going to criticize. A movement like Lubavitch needs hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars a year. You need people who can give it. Yomo can't give it. Right, Yomo, am I embarrassing you or am I telling the truth? The truth, Baruch Hashem.
Maybe one day.
Exactly. Shlomo, I hope one day with Yomo together we'll be able to. But I don't like people. The fact is, she found an open heart on the Upper East Side. Ultimately, they bought a building. And Hineni has its own building. not on the Upper East Side, on the Upper West Side. In the heart of the Upper West Side, Broadway, West End Avenue, the 70s, I'll give you the exact address. I'll show you a picture of the building. Yomo found it on online for me, Google, and Google Maps, I think they call it. And this lady, the more she spoke, the more people loved her, the more people heard about her, the more invitations she got. And she wound up speaking in the Army, in the Navy. Jewish chaplains, non-Jewish chaplains. How many women do you have that can speak like her, that are emotional, that have a life story like her? Israel will see the Army, will see the prisons. And mind you, her English was perfect. Her Hebrew didn't equal her English, but people understood the heart, people, the emotion, you see. This, you'll see from what I'll quote from her, she knew how to hit the heart. Not everyone, they're intellectuals, you know, they laugh until you poke them a certain way, but they're people, and most people, most Jews have a heart yet, have a feeling. This is what Hasidus is based upon, the Pintaliyid, the Klipot. You understand what I'm saying? Shlomo, the Yestach, I know I'm talking Klipot. You have to know how to peel away the Klipot and get to the heart. And I always say, what's the heart? What the Malach taught you. That every Jew has that inborn feeling that you can reach him. You just have to know how to get to the heart. And the Rebbetzin had that ability unlimited, something unbelievably special. She could move mountains. Now, here too I have to give credit to the Jewish press. When the Jewish press first started coming out, the Rav was embarrassed by it. Why was the Rav embarrassed? The English was very poor. It's not like today. Yomo types an email for me. If he makes a mistake, generally the computer will catch it. It corrects it. It's an amazing world today. The only problem with the computer is if you type in a word that's a word and it's not the right word, that it generally will not catch. And the Jewish press began, with their mistakes. And I remember the press began, if I'm not mistaken, in the mid-70s. I remember, not mid-70s, mid-50s. And I remember one Wednesday after class, remember, by the time we were with the Rav, a year, two, three, four, we became more relaxed with him. And I remember one time the boys asked him, Rebbe, what do you think of the Jewish press? Everyone is reading it. And the Rav said, I hate to tell you, they send it to me in Boston and I just get rid of it. Oh, the English, you know, the Rav, Boston, Harvard, Yale, Dartmouth, all the top schools, right or wrong, men, women, MIT, and here you have English that's not on the level. He was embarrassed. But you're going to give the Jewish press credit. They had, Mayor Kahana wrote for them weekly, Esther Jungreis wrote weekly, and they gave them a salary. They gave them spending money. They never had to appeal to people for pocket money, etc. You got to give credit. She wrote regularly for the Jewish press. Later, her articles, some of her talks appeared in four different books, just like Mayer, various books. But unless you heard her personally, knew her personally, you couldn't appreciate what this lady accomplished. When she died, the New York Times called her the Jewish Billy Graham. And I have to say, think about it, the Jewish Billy Graham, not a bad nickname, description of the Rebbetzin. Okay. Now, let's retrace our steps.
Did you guys know who Billy Graham was?
Elliot, you certainly know Billy Graham. It's your time. Shlomo, do you know who Billy Graham was? I'm a musician. Gentlemen over the world, a wonderful young student just said he thinks Billy Graham was a musician. You better Google Billy Graham today. He was a preacher, a Protestant preacher. And he was considered the top preacher in the United States. How much he loved Jews, I'll let you do your own research and come up with an answer.
He filled stadiums.
Which stadium did he fill?
Probably a lot of them.
A lot of them. I don't know. The Phil Yankee Stadium, the old stadium held about 70,000 people. Wow. The new stadium, I think, is only 55,000. And today they make their money over the computer. In other words, anyone you can buy in, I think, $125 and get every game on your computer. And it's an amazing thing what goes on today. Baseball makes more money out of the stadium than in the stadium. But okay, leave it to baseball. In the meantime, the Yankees ligging in dread, so I take the smile off my face. Back here. Now, let's understand the Rebbetzin's family, who she came from. And she had a repertoire of stories, of experiences that everyone heard. If you heard her once, twice, three times, these stories registered. I'm going to try to follow in a chronological order, and I also will introduce to you some of the key stories of people she brought to Yiddishkeit. And there, too, you see her impact and the whole relationship, what type of person she was. And literally, there's not a negative story, a negative word that you can say about the Rebbetzin. All right, she dealt with the rich. That was the nature of the beast. It doesn't mean she didn't deal with the poor. She was on the Upper East Side, the Upper West Side. Sure, that's where the Jews were. But what an individual. Okay, let me begin. Okay, Gesundheit. Now, the book I'm quoting from, and I'm happy this book came out. I believe it came out this very year. I bought it, I'm trying to think when. I had a lot of material beforehand, but this book was very good as far as organization. It's called The Rebbetzin, The Story of Rebbetzin Esther Jungreis, Her Life, Her Vision, Her Legacy. It's by Rabbi Nachman Seltzer. Now, the book, Baruch Hashem, has pictures of women. It's about a woman, and it has pictures time and again of the Rebbetzin and life stories. I'm quoting from page 222. We just mentioned that here's this little girl, the Nazis, 1944, May of 44, the Nazis are taking them to a death camp, they're stuffed into a cattle car. Have you any idea what it is like to be stuffed into a cattle car, nowhere to breathe, no food to eat? And they reach a stop, the train stops, and they don't know if they're going to be alive or not going to be alive. And miraculously, they're transferred to the Kastner train. And the Kastner train, those of you who read the memoir literature or what's been written about the train, suddenly it goes to Bergen-Belsen. No one knew what was happening. Bergen-Belsen, they thought that they're going to be executed. They thought the deal did not go through, but it only turned out to be a temporary stop of a few weeks. But here they are in Bergen-Belsen, piles of dead bodies lying on the street. living people were not living. And she describes people were starved. What a sight this little girl is seeing. But even in the worst place in the world, Rav Avram Jungreich remained the same tzaddik of the Yid, the same wonderful father, the same incredible human being. He had to give them something, had to give them hope. How could he do it? And all week he would tell the children, his three children, wait, wait, count the days, it soon will be Shabbos. And Shabbos came, and he would pull out of his pocket little crumbs of bread. Every day, when he ate the bread, the little bit, he'd take off a little piece to save. And in this camp, in the midst of the worst terror imaginable, quote, my precious lights, my beautiful Kinderlach, close your eyes, close your eyes. We are at home. Mama baked the most delicious challah. It's fresh and hot. And then he would take out the crumbs and distribute it to the children. And he would sing Shalom Aleichem, welcoming the angels of Shabbat. One Friday night, Esther's younger brother, Binyamin, turned to his father and said, Tati, ich seh nicht kein Malachim, I can't see any angels. Where are the Shabbos angels? And Rav Avram Jungreich, tears rolling down his sunken cheeks, stroked his young son's face and replied, in his warmest and most comforting voice, you, my children, you are the angels of Shabbat. And I need not tell you, to tell a story like this to youngsters who have the best of everything, never lacked, never were hungry, and this is what Jews went through. It opens your heart. And she would say here, as young as she was, she looked around. Esther looked at them, the gentlemen of the master race. And she said to herself, Baruch Hashem, bless me Hashem that I am not the daughter of your people, that I'm the daughter of my father and mother, the daughter of a nation that stood at Sinai and heard the voice of Hashem and lives with the covenant that Hashem gave us, and not the daughter of a nation of brutes and murderers. And I need not tell you, this very powerful, because the women at the Kotel, excuse me, made the bracha over the Torah, Asher Bachabanu Im Kol Ha'amim. And we don't have to say an extra word. Just tell the story of Esther Jungreich, and we know what bracha we have to make. And I can follow up, if you recall, perhaps the greatest lectures I ever gave, some 30 plus years ago. I gave 5 years on Holocaust response literature. 1980s, some point into the, could be into the 90s. I don't know how much of it is on YU Torah, but in some of the memoir literature, there was a Rav who lived literally up the block from where I lived, and he was a survivor, published volumes, and in one of the volumes, he tells a story that as they're deporting Jews to the death camp, so they're deporting the older Jews, or those who can't work, to kill them, and the younger ones are still being left behind to work for the Nazis. And as this Jew is getting onto the train, he yells to his friend, who's younger and is going to be left behind, remember to feed the animals before you eat. I didn't feed them. I couldn't do it today. And you know, that's the halacha that you're supposed, the Rav used to talk about, the Belya Prishina, and I can remember the Rav saying, is given our grace of tumul, that there was turmoil in the house when the Belya Prishina had to eat, because he had to know that all the animals that they had chickens and cows, every animal had to be fed before him. And I remember he said, the Rabbi, in that memoir literature, he says, Shelo Asani Gai. And that's exactly what Esther Jungreis is saying, Shelo Asani Gaya. Wow. And imagine the chutzpah, women at the Kotel, that we've gone through with the Germans and the British, and with the Americans today, with assimilated, self-hating Jews, and with Ben and Jerry, and the lady who runs the place, and the illegal money to the Arabs to murder us, pay for slay, and how many of our own people that I know, I can give you a long, long list of people I know who were killed by terrorists. And Shebachabanu Im Ha'amim? Wow. They should have read Esther Jungreis's book. Let me just go one step further. And this is a very beautiful story, and you'll see the implications in today's world. I'm quoting again. I heard this story in Bnei Akiva already. The story is about Yaakov, the older brother. Yaakov probably is about 3 years older than I am, 4 years older. He was principal of the yeshiva in Coney Island, if I'm not mistaken, and had a shul in that area. Could be Canarsie, Coney Island. They're not near each other? No, it's Canarsie that he had, that the yeshiva, the shul, and forget about Coney Island. I'm thinking of Galinsky. And I think this is originally where his father had a shtibble when they came to America. And he and Bnei Akiva, I remember my year in Camp Moshava, he gave many, many sichot. But this is a fascinating story about him as a little kid. Here they are already, the Nazis have established the ghetto. A ghetto in the, family, the Jungreis family is in the ghetto, and a lady is pregnant. And no one knew what to do. Where should the lady give birth? If the lady will give birth and the Nazis know, they'll kill the kid. So Rabbi Avram Jungreis keeps on thinking, and at that point there still were shuls in the ghetto, and he brings the lady into the shul. They set up a bed in front of the Aron Kodesh, and she gives birth on that bed. They got away with it. The baby is born. They do a bris in the mikveh. The Nazis yet hadn't destroyed the mikvot. And here you see, under these conditions, the baby born, brit. But what do you do for diapers? What do you do for medicine? What do you do for all that a baby needs after the brit? And they drop a list, and Yaakov was, I believe, about 8 years old at the time, and they tell Yankee, jump over the fence, get out of the ghetto, go to the other part of the city, make believe you're a non-Jew, and buy what you can, pay for it, and get back to us. A newborn needs many things. At that moment, the newborn had nothing, not even a diaper. And little Yankee, as young as he is, jumps over the fence, gets to the drugstore, buys everything on the list, and he gets back safely. All right. Later, they're all deported, and that mother, her life is saved with the baby. How is her life saved? One of the rabbis that Kastner wanted to put on his train, his name, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kohn. It's the grandmother of Esther Jungreis via her mother. That rabbi, when they came to him and said, there's a place for you and your wife on the train, do you know what he said? I want you to take this lady and her baby. I want to remain with my shul. And that's how their life was saved. So this lady, there's a picture of the rabbi, a picture of his wife here. His wife doesn't survive the Holocaust. He does. He later becomes Rav in Paterson, New Jersey. He publishes a Sefer Likutei Tzvi al HaTorah and Nosaf Lezeh Sefer Zichronot of what he went through in the Holocaust, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kohn. And the lady with the baby whose life he saved, get on the Kastner train, get to Switzerland, get to America, and she remarries. Her first husband died, she remarries. And who does she remarry? The Tselema Rav. Tselema Rav's first family, Grunwald, was wiped out in the Holocaust. He adopts this little boy. It was not his child, but he adopts him and raises him, and he's the Tselema Rav today. So that the Tselema Rav's life was saved by Yanki Jungreis. Yaakov Jungreis, Jacob Jungreis, know him what, whichever name you know him by. In Bnei Akiva it was Yanki, Yaakov. I see today he's addressed at times as Jacob Jungreis. But you see, this is the family, this is the Holocaust, this is what they're going through, and take a look what comes out of it. Doing one act, you never know what will come out of one act. Shlomele, in a few minutes, I'm going to show you one act that I did, and I'm going to show you some of the fruit that is starting to grow on the tree. One act, one person, you never know. Yanki risked his life, a little kid, jumping over the fence, getting the diapers, the medicine, what they wanted on the list, money paid, ran back, saved this little kid. Look at his, what Rabbi Kohn did. Refused to go on the Kastner transport. Let me stay with my people. So you see, this is Esther. She never forgot the Holocaust. As you will see, I still haven't gotten to the heart of her quotes. But she's talking to an audience. She's talking to American kids. She's talking to kids from Holyoke, Massachusetts. Yomo, who do you know from Holyoke? No? Who do you know? Elliot, who do you know from Holyoke? Mark Wiener, Holyoke, what are we talking about? And these kids are seeking, they're searching. You hear stories like this. It purifies the soul. You're a different person. You're a different person. And we'll come back to that. So to reiterate, what have we done so far today? All right, we finished off Meir Kahana. We dealt with Benji Goldstein. It's a tremendous tragedy. Ugh. I remember when it happened, how I cried in class and said, had he only asked me. I was quite close to the family, but I wasn't in his ballpark. But anyone he had asked would have told him, what are you, an idiot? You have a wife and four children. How can you shoot, kill? How do you know they're guilty? You did your research, you put them on trial, you had a jury. Innocent people could be among them. Some of them could have been murderers, but you're not allowed to kill a murderer and kill five innocent people with him. And this is very, very problematic. And I learned that early in teaching. I remember in BMT with Rabbi Gorin, I felt very bad. And this kid, by the way, the end of the story is very different. He becomes very black. He leaves BMT, he leaves the Mizrahi, where he leaves Rabbi Gorin, he leaves Aaron Rakefer or Rothkopf, I was at the time. And he goes, and I lost track of him. Went into the black world. I remember he was learning in Lakewood, and I lost track of him. I taught his sister. His father took over my shul as rabbi for a nice few years in Maplewood, South Orange. Good people, but wow, you gotta low-key understand life is not black and white. Life, a lot of gray. Can we use the umbrella on Shabbat? Can't we use the umbrella? Oh boy, La Yehuda Maita Ora V'Simcha V'Sim in Mamalashen V'Tzayn Freilich. You know what that means, Yomo? It's V'Tzayn Freilich. It's going to be happy. We're going to Baruch Hashem. It won't be dull. All right, then we started the Rebbetzin. We reviewed her life very briefly. You know, we spoke a little bit about the Holocaust. We have to pick up the Rebbetzin in America, the grandfather, the grandmother, the impact, and we're going to have to live with the Neuberger family. And there you have an in-line, detailed, real description of what happened, the Rebbetzin and her impact on one family, and from that one family you can change a good part of the world. Okay, now I want to tell you a little story. You do a good an act, you do a favor. The reason I love Yomo, and I have to be honest, it's very simple. When he fed into my hands in the Kollel years ago, over a decade ago, so here's a kid from the Ukraine. And after risking my life in Russia to see a kid from the Ukraine learning Torah, rakadati mirov simcha. Okay, you can understand that. Well, when we came back from Russia and I got involved with the Mossad and I'm sending people, so I would do anyone a favor. And anyone I sent who came back, you talk about Rabbi Rubin, his wife Judy Zichrona Levracha, she didn't waste a minute helping Olim from Russia. She ran out of their house. They would collect furniture, secondhand furniture, send it on to Russian Olim, people who needed it. The tzidkut is overwhelming. So among the people I sent was the principal, one of the principals of Horeb and his wife, Rabbi Shlomo Merzel, Zeicher Tzadik Livracha. And he was overwhelmed and would do anything I wanted. A family got out of Russia. There's a student listening now, Nachum Lamb. Okay, he's on the screen. A cousin of his mother, a lot of the family got out of Russia, cousins, and part went to America and part came to Israel. The family that came to Israel wanted to live like real Jews. And they wanted their son to go to Chorev. Chorev? You want to get a kid into Chorev? You got to stand on your head. The school is crowded. Every last class, every seat is taken. No dice. No. Yeah, Chorev. All right. So they called me. And they asked me if I could get the kid into Chorev. I called Rabbi Merzel. And this little kid was in Chorev, his name Aaron Chaim Saksonov. And now it's many years later. And this little kid, while I've gotten into Chorev, these are some of his Kiddushei Torah. You should see the level that he writes on, his Hebrew, his depth. And sugyas, bracha la priyo, bracha al hateva. He, sugya after sugya, all of Shas, learned afterwards with Rabinovich in Mala Adumim, hadarat hakriyotaryonim la'avat ula toldat. I can go on and on quoting from what he wrote. And this is just the start. He's starting now. He's after Army, after Hezda. He's learning around the clock. One little act of chesed, and take a look. You build an entire world. So this is one thing. Food for thought. This is an article that appeared in Mochach. This is the magazine for the new generation of Makor Rishon that came out a week ago, not this Friday, but a week ago Friday. And here's an article on a Chabotnik, a real sweet, innovative individual, HaRebbe HaMerakei, the Dancing Rebbe. And boy, did I enjoy this article. This is his wife. She's also an Ishi Yeroni Chabad. Turns out couples like this. And he performs weddings. And he dances into the wedding. He speaks with the Chatan Vakala before. And what interests them, he arranges the music to be to their taste. And the Chiloniim love him. Among the Chabadnikim, yesh v'yesh. Some of them say he's doing great, and some say he's a little bit too innovative. But it's fabulous food for thought. If anyone wants to take this further, you're welcome. If anyone wants to see the Chidushei Torah of Aaron Chaim Saksonon, you're welcome. And here are two copies, two very interesting pieces on Rabbi Moshe David Tendler by a student, my chavruta Rav Tendler. And it captures Rav Tendler, the independent thinker. Let no one push him around. And finally, I have some material there. If no one claims that it will go out, it hurts me. But if anyone knows people with a Hasidic soul, I have many pictures of the Gera Rebbe in Borough Park a few weeks ago, and material on the Lubavitcher Rebbe and his influence on a professor in Montreal, and some other material that a Hasidic soul will greatly appreciate. Are there any questions in the classroom? Okay, I want to say until we meet again in health and happiness, das v'danya, v'ani modela kadosh baruch hu, that Mark's radio, or whatever you call it, worked and broadcast to the world. Open it up with any questions from the great galut that's looking at me.
Rebbe?
Yeah.
As far as I know, the Tzomet mic in Spanish-Portuguese was turned off years ago. And I understand it was taken out completely.
Why did they do that?
I don't think they were. Some people there weren't Tzomet on even before the present Rav.
Interesting, because I know Rabbi Angel was there.
I think they may have had the old one in before also. There was one there, and I think the one in the Hamptons was supposedly a fluidic system. I'm not sure if that's the same as the Tzomet system.
When I was in the Hamptons, it was the Tzomet system. That much I can tell you. And they told me...
You can tell because they would have a sign.
It was the Tzomet system. I don't know today. But okay, thank you.
No, it didn't have the sign in the Spanish-Portuguese.
Okay, check it out. Let me know if it's removed. I have to say they removed it. KJ doesn't need it. Rabbi Lukstein's voice is a built-in microphone to the 10th power. I don't know about the new rabbi, but Rabbi Lukstein... He could speak above a crowd of 70,000 people in Yankee Stadium and be heard. I was always envious of his voice. Take my word for it. Any other question? Yes,
yeah,
Jay.
I just wanted to say that Benji was a classmate of mine at Yeshiva. I took a class with him. He was an outstanding student, needless to say. And just an ironic postscript, the story is that in my era at Yeshiva, there were two major graduation awards. One was for the valedictorian, and the other was, if I'm not mistaken, it was called the Lieberman Award, and it was voted by the student body for the most for the individual with the most outstanding character. And of course, for those of us who are aware that Denshi was the recipient of that recognition, it added another measure of heartbreak and irony to what eventually happened to him. It was called the Philip Lieberman Award as the outstanding, as the graduating student with an outstanding character.
Wow. That is unbelievable. It's such a tragedy. Does anyone know that his wife remarried? What happened with the family? And, you know, they buried him and it became a monument and the left went crazy. But I have to tell you, I agree with the left on that issue. Chas v'chalila, we should hold up. This is an example of proper behavior. It breaks the heart. And I come back to Golda Meir. I forgive, what did she say? I can forgive the Arabs for everything except for turning our sons into murderers, right? Is that the right word, Rabbi Rubin?
Something of that nature. I'll get the exact quote for you.
What's the word? I was corrected on it. They're not killers, they're murderers. Okay, any more questions? The new class is coming in here, so I have to exit. I want to thank everyone for participating and keeping awake. I am very moved, and I hope that next week I'll be able to tell you that we're giving the shiur, and it's a system that cannot go down. I hope Yomo is informing me correctly.
There's no system that can't go down.
I have the quote here. It's a very powerful quote. It says, "We can forgive the Arabs for killing our children. We cannot forgive them for forcing us to kill their children.
Wow.
We will only have peace with the Arabs when they love their children more than they hate us."
Wow. Very powerful. Very powerful. Cool. All right. We have to live with it. Nachum, tell him.
What you said, the whole family. He has cousins also in Nubia, the sects, the other sects of the branch, and you should see them also. Hey, it's quite something that happened to the whole family. It's really.
And they're all here in Israel. They're all here in Israel. The family.
A bunch of cousins wound up in America. There are all sorts of stories of my cousins as to what happened to them. It's one of them was in Chernobyl, so he got cancer from the. So he got taken in by the what was it, Camp Simcha, and he became from everyone somehow wound up. One that wound up in Lakewood somehow. It's a whole
beautiful.
That particular branch is all in Israel.
Beautiful. Yeah. Do me a favor. Tell your parents what I spoke about today.
Okay.
Listen, there's a lot of food for thought, but we're just scratching the surface. You'll see that the Rebbetzin had some fantastic pithy quotes that you don't have to be a genius to understand what she was saying, and she hit home. There's one picture in the book that says everything. It's typical, typical YU looking kid, typical Stern College girl, listening to her at Madison Square Garden, and they're crying. And that picture says it all. I'd love to know their names and where they are today, almost 50 years later. But the Rebbetzin, her sweet, it's beyond words, but this one lady accomplished, but she had the right husband. He knew how to step in. He stepped into the background, and he let her go all over the world, l'kavod u'l'tiferet. Yes, Nachum.
I remember a New York magazine wrote a whole article about her once. And not just her, I think there's a bunch of people, but she was a big thing, and there's a picture of her speaking, and I remember there's a picture of my sisters just sitting in the front row. Like you couldn't see that, but we knew, all that stuff.
Do me a favor, go online, see if you can turn up the article and send me a link to it.
It was about Bala Tshuva in general. I think they had the interview Rabbi Lukstein and a bunch of other people. Uh-huh. So I'll see if I can find it.
See if it's online.
Now her daughter is a gifted speaker. Slavi Wolf has picked up the
Wait a minute.
Slavi Wolf lectures and she's outstanding. And also in this in a similar demeanor to her mother.
Wow.
Very powerful.
Where does she live, Slavy Wolf?
She lives in Lawrence, but she maintains a facility on the west side. From Sao Paulo, very successful businessman who supports their activities, and a fellow named Mindy Wolf, and Slavy, he lectures all over the world. In that same mold as her mother. I missed the opportunity to tell you, I'll tell you another time, that I attended one of her events in Miami Beach in the huge convention center. I think it was named for Jackie Gleason.
Right.
I think we were in...
Right.
It might have been my freshman year at YU, and it was tremendously impactful. It was, and the room was packed to the rafters. A huge auditorium.
So you're living testimony to who this lady was. Now, they have. Yeah. She has a daughter living here in Israel. I think they were involved in it.
I don't know, but I know Slavy is in the Five Towns.
Right.
They have a home here in Yerushalayim, but they're based in New York.
She has a son living in Bethel, if I'm not mistaken, Osha. And if I'm not mistaken, I don't want to say there was a tragedy with a car crash. If anyone can fill me with the details, you're welcome to. Okay, I see. Wow, all right. I want to thank everyone for participating. And once again, mi modela Kadosh Baruch Hu, that the technological problems did not put us down. Yesterday, I'll tell you what hurt me so much is that people are staying up all night to listen to the shiur in the States. And imagine they stay up and then it's 2 o'clock at a.m., Raket is beginning, and he goes off, and we're hitting our heads against the wall here. And it was just a...
Rabbi, you'd be remiss if you don't do a short shout-out to the Red Sox. I know you're a baseball fan at heart. You have to give credit where credit is due.
One second. They won again. I know they were 1-1, and what happened? They're going further with the playoffs. The Red Sox?
Yes.
So, okay.
They're buying for the pennant now.
Buying for the pennant, right. Okay. So I'll tell you, if they go into the World Series, I will root for the Red Sox for one simple reason, because the Rev came from Boston. I'm giving the same reason I gave to a few years ago, because for a Yankee fan to root for the Red Sox, very difficult. But if push comes to shove, I'm rooting for the Red Sox.
The Red Sox were playing this series 1 year in YU, and the Rav called everyone out for a minion for Myriv, but he asked the score first.
So that's the famous story that Reb Michal Katz, let me recall my first Rebbe in the Yeshiva, Reb Michal Katz, Seichet Tzadik Levracha. So he was a greenhorn, had come back to America, and he had to make a little extra money. And he was hired by a shul in Miami Beach for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And on Yom Kippur, before Ne'ilah, the president of the shul gives him a note and says, Rabbi, you must announce this. Just read it. And it was the World Series, the Yankees and the Cardinals, I think, 42. Check it out. And he announces Yankees 5, Cardinals 2, you know, something like that. And the place goes crazy, some with joy, some in tears, and he didn't know what was going on. Later, he found out, as he became more American, he was announcing the score of the final game of the World Series. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das bedan. Yes, thank you so much.
If you get here at 2 a.m. there, it would be day over here and you wouldn't have any noise.
You're right. If I gave share, the only thing is at 2 a.m. I wouldn't have anyone sitting in front of me, and my wife would be a little bit upset, to say the least. Okay, but that's a good idea. Good gazak. Okay, we gotta get ready.
Recording stopped.